As we begin, we're going to be in John chapter 21 this morning, closing out our study in the Gospel of John. And before we get to the text of Scripture, I'd like to read an excerpt from Max Licato's book entitled, You Are Special. Unfortunately, you can't see all the illustrations, although I think we have one here that you can see. The Wemmicks were small wooden people. All of the wooden people were carved by a woodworker named Eli. His workshop sat on a hill overlooking the village. Each Wemmick was different. Some had big noses, others had large eyes. Some were tall and others were short. Some wore hats, others wore coats, but all were made by the same carver and all lived in the village. And all day, every day, the Wemmicks did the same thing. They gave each other stickers. Each Wemmick had a box of golden star stickers and a box of gray dot stickers. Up and down the streets, all over the city, people spent their days sticking stars or dots on one another. The pretty ones, those with smooth wood and fine paint, always got stars. But if the wood was rough or the paint chipped, the Wemmicks gave dots. The talented ones got stars too. Some could lift big sticks high above their heads or jump over tall boxes. Still others knew big words or could sing pretty songs. Everyone gave them stars. Some Wemmicks had stars all over them. Every time they got a star, it made them feel so good. It made them want to do something else and get another star. Others, though, could do little. They got dots. Punchinello, pictured here in this illustration, was one of those. He tried to jump high like the others, but he always fell. And when he fell, the others would gather around and give him dots. Sometimes when he fell, his wood got scratched, so the people would give him more dots. Then when he would try to explain why he fell, he would say something silly and the Wemmicks would give him more dots. After a while, he had so many dots that he didn't want to go outside. He was afraid he would do something dumb, such as forget his hat or step in the water, and then people would give him another dot. In fact, he had so many gray dots that some people would come up and give him one for no reason at all. It's funny that Wemmicks encounter that dynamic. I find that people do too. We are inclined to evaluate each other, to gauge ourselves against one another, to measure our success or failure in comparison to someone else. I believe there's part of this that is uniquely human. We are created in the image of God, and as such, we are created with a capacity to worship God. And more generally, we are created with a capacity to worship. So we hold up cards that say 9.5 or 10 when there's been a really exceptionally good dive in the Olympics. Penguins don't do that at the North Pole, at least that we've been able to observe. It's uniquely human. We have this ability to be moved to adoration or worship when someone has talent or some other commodity that impresses us. But of course, that whole aspect of comparison and the giving of stars and dots is a distortion, a perversion of that capacity, that worship capacity. It becomes what Paul describes as the inclination to worship the creature rather than the Creator. Romans chapter 1. And usually we come away from the comparison with one of two reactions, neither of which are very good, depending on who we've compared ourselves to that day. We come away with, first, maybe a feeling of inadequacy, feeling like I can't measure up with that person. Or on the other hand, perhaps I come away with a feeling of arrogance. I'm doing pretty good. But in both cases, we miss the real point. And I think the text this morning here in John 21 helps us to consider the real point and the danger of comparison. Let's look in John 21, verse 20 through the end of the chapter. John 21, 20. Hear the word of the Lord. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had been reclining at table close to him and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it is my will that he remains until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but "If it is my will that when he that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now, there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. Have to remember as we come to this text that there is a context here. In the preceding verses, Jesus had told Peter that he was going to die a martyr's death. He said his hands were going to be spread out and he was going to be led in a way that he did not want to go. And the spreading of the hands was a euphemism for crucifixion. Church history tells us that Peter indeed was crucified. Matter of fact, all but John did die violent deaths, the deaths of martyrs. And so in the point of reflection, as Peter thought about Jesus' comments, which really in one sense were a commendation to Peter, before Jesus had said, "You are going to deny me." And now Jesus says, "No, you will be faithful to the point of death." But as Peter thinks about this, his mind inevitably drifts to John, another disciple who is very close to Jesus, who is part of the inner circle within the 12. And Peter says, "What about him? What about him?" Jesus gave a very succinct reply. It's reiterated here. It's given in verse 22 and reiterated by John in verse 23. And it's that succinct little charge to Peter that I want to focus on this morning. I think here we find some reminders for us when we are tempted to compare, when we're tempted to measure ourselves next to someone else or look to someone else's lot in life instead of our own. So here are the reminders. The first is this, that Jesus is sovereign over life and death and the circumstances of our lives. Jesus is sovereign over life and death and the circumstances of our lives. If it is my will. That's how Jesus begins this brief little charge. If it is my will. So we're talking about John's life. Will he be asked to die a martyr's death as well? Will his life be cut short? This is the question, right? This is what Peter's asking. What about him? Will he have to pay the same price that I will have to pay? And Jesus responds, if it is my will. See, the risen Jesus possesses authority over death. We're told in Revelation 1 that he holds the keys to death and Hades. We're told that he holds the keys of David in Revelation chapter 3. Very interesting allusion taken out of Isaiah, but the one who held the keys to the kingdom, for whom everything was available, every resource, to hold the keys of King David was to have everything at your disposal. Jesus holds the keys of David, for when he opens something, no one can shut it, and when he shuts something, no one can open it. No one. Absolute sovereign power that is possessed by Jesus. How significant for Peter as he would face persecution that he could think about the fact that he was not left to blind fate or the cruelty of a pagan ruler. It was part of God's sovereign plan. Certainly Peter would have got a glimpse into this. All of this, his lot, John's lot, was all being worked out according to the plan of an all-powerful and sovereign God. Alexander McLaren, a contemporary of C.H. Spurgeon, noted that Peter was imprisoned once and delivered. Remember the account there in the book of Acts? Remember, Peter came out, the people were praying. Peter, the angel leads Peter out of prison. And he comes to the prayer meeting and they're all shocked to see Peter there. Remember that episode? McLaren reflects on this. He says, Peter was imprisoned once and delivered in order that when he was put in another prison and not delivered, he would know that it was not a matter of God's inadequacy, but of his sovereign will. Peter went to his crucifixion. He went knowing that God could have rescued him if he chose to. A powerful, powerful message that Peter was receiving here. And God's will is not constrained by anything. When we talk about Jesus determining to do something, I think it's important for us to realize my will is sometimes constrained. I am forced to do certain things that sometimes I don't want to do. That's never the case with Jesus. Spurgeon in his catechisms, question number 7, poses the question, what are the decrees of God? And this is part of his answer. The decrees of God are his eternal purpose according to the counsel of his own will. No one tells Jesus what to do. No one twists Jesus' arm behind his back and says, you'll do it or else. Jesus does what he intends to do. Period. Wonderful reminder for us when we go through uncertain times. But I would want us to note here that Jesus' goal for Peter or for John was not fairness, as we might understand it. That Jesus' goal is not your happiness. Jesus' goal is the accomplishment of his own will. I love the subtitle of Gary Thomas's book, Sacred Marriage. It poses the question, what if God intended marriage to make you holy more than to make you happy? Ouch. Now, God's consideration here, Jesus' concern in all of this was not Peter's sense of fairness or his life of ease, but it was all part of a larger plan and a larger purpose of his will being accomplished. Remember, probably 5 or 6 years ago, maybe longer, Joel Stoll challenged pastors at the conference at Moody Bible Institute. And he said, some of you are here as pastors, he said, and you're feeling sorry for yourselves. You're pastoring a small church. You're pastoring a small rural church in the backwoods of Montana. And it doesn't seem like anything's happening. People aren't responding. People aren't learning. People aren't growing. People aren't changing. And then he posed that question. He said to all of you, he said, who are thinking like that, who are feeling sorry for yourselves. By the way, it's not just pastors who sometimes feel sorry for themselves, right? He said, did it ever enter your puny little brain that it might not be about you? It may be that pastor in Backwoods, Montana is serving faithfully and his son is watching. And his son will be the one that will be the next great evangelist, next great missionary, next faithful teacher in a local church. Do you ever stop to think it might not be about you? This is certainly the reminder that Peter received here as he tries to enter into comparison. It's not about me. It's about God's sovereign plan. For purposes known only to God Himself, God might allow you to endure a difficult marriage, to lose a child, to have no friends at school, or to develop dyslexia or any other number of disabilities. In the midst of this, as you look around you, you're tempted to compare, you can be assured that these circumstances are purposeful, not random. God is desiring to use these things to accomplish His will. Number two, we've each been given a unique predetermined allotment or set of circumstances. We've each been given a unique predetermined allotment. If it is my will that he, John, remain. Peter was going to live on the edge. He would be at the hub of a revolution that would change the world. And fittingly, he was going to go out in a blaze as a martyr. And yet Jesus paints a scenario regarding John that is very different and distinct. John was going to remain or continue or abide. It was a stationary term. It speaks of a patient resting in a fixed position. That's not Peter, is it? It certainly doesn't describe Peter's ministry, but it was seemingly going to be John's ministry. John was going to be exiled to the island of Patmos, where he would live out his days and die of old age, presumably. Now, Peter and John were both committed disciples. They were both passionate and fully committed to the Great Commission. They were both part of Jesus' inner circle. Peter, James, and John were part of that inner three, even among the 12. But their ministries were very different. Thousands responded to the gospel through Peter's preaching. But how many were impacted by John's writing? Including us. See, while their ministries were different, they were both important, both critical, both invaluable in God's eyes. Paul had to urge the believers in Corinth to remain in the station where they had been placed. Paul saw this as a tendency even in the early church, this tendency of comparison. In 1 Corinthians 12, they were aspiring towards kind of the flashy gifts, the flashy upfront roles in the local church. And Paul had to kind of reel them in a little bit. He wrote this, 1 Corinthians 12, "But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as He chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body." So God has designed and chosen individuals to carry out certain roles. Some are up front, some involve speaking, some involve serving. And certainly Peter learned a lesson here as he was inclined to compare that God has different roles for different people, all within the common cause of the Great Commission. But all different. 1 Corinthians 7, Paul charges the believers there, "Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him." and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. There he's speaking specifically within the context of marriage and people that were concerned or discontent with where they were. And Paul says at some level, you have to grapple with the fact that this is what God has for you. This is his place. This is the arena of ministry that he's carved out for you. This marriage to an unbelieving husband or this child that is wayward or a special needs child, whatever it might be. God's called you to a particular context in which he wants you to serve him. Puritan preacher John Bunyan had a very effective ministry among and throughout the villages there in Bedford in England. But it was his novel, Pilgrim's Progress, which had the greatest impact. And that all came about as a result of a dream that he had, or so it is said, while he sat in the Bedford jail. I'm sure Bunyan must have thought, oh, I'm on the shelf here. I would like to be out preaching. I'd like to be impacting people, only to realize that his time on the shelf, his time in jail, his time behind bars was going to be what God would use to accomplish his purposes. So again, a couple of dangers. Danger of false humility or kind of underestimating your own gifts and abilities and what God has assigned to you. Some might say, oh, this is really my life is, I really don't have that many opportunities to serve the Lord. And sometimes I'm afraid we as churches have reinforced this bad idea that preachers and missionaries are the ones that really are accomplishing God's work. And that's such a distorted notion. So sometimes we have to be reminded that, hey, my arena of influence and the friendships and in my neighborhood and my workplace, my interactions with my kids as stay-at-home mom, all of these things are just as important as that other person's assignment, even though theirs might be national in scope or international in scope. God has given me a particular assignment that I am called to carry out. And of course, sometimes there's also the reminder here that we can never entertain a prideful spirit. We can never so exalt our own ministry to the detriment of everyone else's. McLaren also wrote about this. He said, "Let us tolerate the forms of service least like our own, not seek to force other men into our paths, nor seek to imitate them." So there's a reminder here, too, that Peter had to acknowledge that John was going to have a unique ministry, and it was a valuable ministry, even though John wasn't going to die for his faith. He was going to accomplish something just as valuable as Peter, although it would be very different. It'd be easy for Peter. Maybe we get a little sense of this, that Peter was kind of feeling like he was being asked to do something or to offer something that John wasn't, that he was somehow better than John because his ministry was different than John's. See the danger there? So whenever we're tempted to compare, we have to remember that we've each been given a unique, predetermined allotment from the Lord. Third, Jesus is coming again. Amen. If it is my will that he remain or abide until I come. Now, those in the early church had taken Jesus' words and made them say something that he didn't intend to say. The saying had been passed down as if it were prophecy that John would remain alive until Jesus returned. John wanted to dispel that notion before he died, to say, no, Jesus presented a hypothetical situation. If it is my will that he remain. But the reality was, Jesus is returning. And Jesus' words constitute a sobering reminder that there will be a time to give an account. And almost every time when Jesus' return is talked about in Matthew 25 and 2 Peter, 1 Thessalonians 4 and 5, and all of these texts, the response is a degree of sobriety, a sense of healthy fear, a reorganizing of priorities that should dominate our thinking. And so here in this text, Jesus speaks to Peter of his return. Before you get too concerned about John, let's remember the fact that I'm coming back. You're not going to care about John when I come back. You're going to care about you. 1 Thessalonians 5, for you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. But you are not in darkness, brothers, for that day to surprise you like a thief, for you are all children of light, children of the day. We are not of the night or of the darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and sober. So there's the reminder that Peter was to absorb, that Jesus was coming again. You'll not be able to point to your neighbor and say, but everyone was wearing short skirts and low-cut tops. I sacrificed financially more than those other families. Yeah, but I was always volunteering to help more than them. There won't be any comparison when you stand before the Lord. Matter of fact, some of you have been given the blessing of growing up in a Christian home. Some of you had opportunities to study the Bible in formal settings, colleges, Bible schools. The fact is, more will be required from you. And you will answer for what you know to be true and what you know God is calling and expecting of you according to His Word. Sometimes, again, we get into these situations where we look pretty good if I pick out the right people to compare myself to. But the fact is, I'm going to stand before a holy God and give an account. Seems to me that this also provides a corrective for our worldview. We're inclined to feel a little bit for Peter here. After all, he did get the short end of the stick, right? Maybe, depending on your perspective. I was reading the story this week of Gideon in Judges chapter 8. Gideon goes out to war against the Midianites. The Midianites have been a thorn in Israel's side, had oppressed them, had killed many of their people. And God raises up Gideon, and Gideon leads a group of men to go, and they defeat Midian. And they come back, and what do you think Gideon gets for his efforts? The men of Ephraim were ticked off. How dare you go out to battle and win the glorious victory and not even tell us you were going? We wanted to be in the front lines. Might be that some here that would like to be in the front lines too, and God might have you working behind the scenes at the moment. It's hard to tell, but when you look at Peter and John, of who had the more privileged position? The fact is, they were both able to hear, "Well done," even though their tasks, again, were very different. Well, final reminder as we draw to a close, that is number four, we are to be content with our own calling and avoid meddling in the calling of others. If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. We don't know what exactly motivated Peter's question. We have seen in the course of the gospel that John was kind of one step ahead of Peter most of the way. He's the one sitting close at Jesus' side at the Last Supper. He makes it to the tomb first. He's the first to actually come to full faith in the resurrection. They're out fishing. We saw in chapter 20, and They bring in this big catch of fish, and it's John who recognizes it is the Lord. Maybe Peter had a little inferiority complex going. I don't know. The sense is, Peter's thinking, ugh. I always have to be upstaged by this guy. If I'm gonna pay this price, I'm not going down alone. And he again began to get into this trap of comparison. Noah's playing baseball this year. And they've been running drills where the coach hits the ball and then the kids run to first. And the rule is they can't look at the ball. You know, you've seen that before. You know, they want them running to the base and they're drilling it into their heads. And there's certain punishment and extra laps they have to run if they look at the ball. And Jesus is saying something similar here to Peter. You follow me. Me. This very specific relationship, this very specific task that I have for you. And it doesn't have anything to do with John. You're not his babysitter. You're all wondering how the story of the Wemmix ends, right? I'll give you one more picture here. I think we have it up here. Punchinello, this little Wemmick with dots all over him, meets a girl that's very different. Her name was Lucia. And Lucia didn't have any dots. Actually, she did get dots, but they didn't stick. They just fell off. And so Punchinello asks her, "What's up with you?" or something like that. And Lucia says, "You need to go see Eli. You need to go see the woodcarver." And so one day Punchinello does that. And here's part of that exchange between Punchinello and Eli the woodcarver. "Every day I've been hoping you'd come," Eli explained. "I came because I met someone who had no marks," said Punchinello. "I know. She told me about you." "Why don't the stickers stay on her?" The maker spoke softly. "Because she has decided that what I think is more important than what they think. The stickers only stick if you let them." What? "The stickers only stick if they matter to you. The more you trust my love, the less you care about their stickers." Punchinello learned a lesson, and I think it's a lesson that Peter had to learn too. Avoid this tendency and this cycle of comparison. We need to make regular trips to the woodcarver, to our maker, to the only one whose opinion really matters. And this section closes with Jesus. I can almost see him having Peter by the ears. "You follow me."